Vice City interviews, roll 34.
I mean, we're getting killed for these people and they don't even appreciate it. They think it's a big joke.
It's been 42 years since America pulled out of Vietnam. It was a conflict that polarized us then, and the tension around it has been a fascination of pop culture ever since. Take, for example, these fictional interviews from the movie Full Metal Jacket.
Do I think America belongs in Vietnam? I don't know. I belong in Vietnam. I'll tell you that.
I wanted to see exotic Vietnam, the jewel of Southeast Asia. I wanted to meet interesting and stimulating people of an ancient culture and kill them. I wanted to be the first kid on my block to get a confirmed kill.
But that's fiction. And fictional characters are frozen in time. They don't change their minds or see things differently. Real people do. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're taking a look back with Kansas Cityans who remember this conflict from very different vantage points. We'll hear from two veterans, a conscientious objector, and you. What was your experience of the Vietnam War? Do you understand something now that wasn't clear to you at the time? We'd love to hear your story, whether you served in the war, lost a friend, or protested here at home. 816-235-2888. Let's start our conversation with Tommy Pond. He served as a Marine from 1964 to 1968, and he did 2.5 tours in Vietnam. Hi, Tommy.
Hello. How are you doing this morning?
Good. How are you?
Very good.
I like your hat. Can you tell our listeners about your hat?
Okay. I'm a Marine, so it's a cover. but it's just what says on there, tough old Marine. And it says Vietnam vet on it. A lot of us Vietnam vets, we have a lot of covers with stuff like that on it.
You grew up in Kansas City, right?
Yes, I did.
Tell me about your upbringing.
Just normal. Just a little lower middle class, I guess. I grew up on 26 in Brooklyn, right down from the stadium there, the old stadium. And went to Lincoln High School and graduated in 64 and went into the Marine Corps before Vietnam was hot and heavy.
What inspired you to go into the Marine Corps?
It wasn't a war going on then. I guess I looked at too many John Wayne movies when I was a kid. I wanted to be a Marine.
What did you know? I mean, when you say Vietnam hadn't started when you became a Marine, you had been there for what, a year first?
Not quite a year when we found out it was January of 65. There was a rumor going around we were going to Vietnam, and frankly, nobody knew what Vietnam was or where it was at or anything. We thought it was just another place to go.
So it was just a name of a place that meant nothing to you?
Nothing to me. It wasn't until right before we left, a little bit before we left, the whole 1st Marine Division packed up and left out of San Diego in 60. About April or May, and that's when we knew we were going to fight.
So help me, you're what, about 18 years old probably,
Yeah, I was
right?
18 years old, yes.
And you're hearing that there's this place called Vietnam that you're going to go. What, did you have questions or thoughts about that?
Then you were 18, you was in the Marine Corps, you went where you was told to go and did what you were supposed to do. That was it.
How did you start putting together an idea of what was going on and what you were doing?
When we hit the beach in July.
Tell me that story.
We hit the beach and expended a lot of ammunition because we was all scared. Everybody was new to this. We had one person, a gunny sergeant, that had been in career. Everybody else was new. We expended a lot of ammunition, and I think we might have killed one person. There might have been five or six out there, but we were shooting at everything because nobody knew anything.
So your sense of what you were doing was just that you were shooting?
Yes, because you were landing on the beach, and we was all scared to death. Nobody never did this before that was there. We was all new to combat.
What about the setting? I mean, what did you make of where you were and what this place was?
There was a beach. We landed on a beach, and you have to realize there was nothing there at Chulai. Our main purpose was to survive security for them to build the airport at Chulai. There wasn't an airport there. They were building it. That's what our main purpose was to do.
So you've said you were scared. Were you? I have to imagine that you were also fairly confused and had a lot of questions.
Confused, yes. Scared, yes. Questions, know, just do what I was supposed to do. I knew as a wireman, I was supposed to lay wire to outposts and stuff, and do what I was told to do. That's then I did not know what to do. I was told what to do. I did it. Later on, I got the hang of it.
So explain to me what your job was, laying wire.
Okay, my job was I was attached to a grunt unit, which is a grunt unit, which is infantry. And my job was to lay wire to that particular company, like if they had an outpost, to lay that wire if they had an outpost someplace, or to lay wire from where we were at back to the command company.
So how you've done 2.5 tours
yes.
of duty in Vietnam, and you said that it took you a while to get the hang of it. What did it mean to get the hang of it? I mean, what is it that you started to understand?
Just what my particular job was in combat and how I was supposed to lay wire. I knew how to lay the wire, but what I was supposed to do, and always a fire team was with me when I went someplace to lay wire to protect me.
So what was it like to come home from these tours?
Okay, in 65, it wasn't that bad. The anti-war protests hadn't gotten hot and heavy then, and it wasn't that bad. In fact, I always tell the story, and this is God's truth. I was coming back and trying to get home for Christmas off of my first tour in December 66. I'm flying military standby. And this older couple had first-class seats. And they gave up their seat because they said, did I get back from over that place? They just called it that place. And I said, yes, I'm trying to get home for Christmas. They said, take my first-class seat. And so I could get in. They took my military standby.
And then your next tour?
I came back home when I got out in 68. It was completely different. People were throwing stuff at me, calling me baby killers. And it was really hectic. I guess all kind of vile names that I can't say on the air.
When you encountered that, had you been aware of the anti-war movement in the United
States?
Oh, yes.
We were all aware of it. And on my second tour in 67 and 68, because it was in the Stars and Stripes newspaper, all the stuff that was going on back home. All that was in the paper. So we got when we get to the Stars and Strike, we knew what was going on back here.
What did you think about that? I mean, we've said that when you first arrived in 65 that you didn't have questions, you were scared, but you didn't know what was going on or really understand the context of your role, like, in this bigger picture. But by the time you're reading these reports, these questions have to be percolating by then.
Actually, frankly, no. The questions started after I got out in 68. Then I was only back home 4 months, and I signed a waiver. You're supposed to be back home. So I signed a waiver to go back to Vietnam because I wasn't very smart. Anyway, I went back, and I didn't have time to really figure out what was going on back here. But when I got out, I started thinking about the war. But then I just went back. And I knew what I was doing by then, and I just did my job.
When you thought about it later, did you think about it differently than you had while you were there?
A little bit, yes. Yes, I really did. I guess the reasons we were there, why people, Americans were being killed and stuff. And while I was in, you're a Marine, you do your job. If they tell you to point your rifle and shoot, if you're a grunt or if you're not, you just support them the best way you can.
When you say, though, that later you thought about why we were there and things like that, what did you think?
I just thought that maybe there could have been another way. And then the more I read, I found out a lot of things about it. I thought Ho Chi Minh was this bad communist dude, the one in communism, the domino effect. We were taught that on the ship, the domino effect. If we don't stop him now, the whole world's going to be red communist. And we thought we were these gung-ho dudes going over there to stop communism. In fact, I never knew Ho Chi Minh asked the United States for help to get out of France until I got out and read stuff like that.
Tommy Pond, stay with me for a minute, okay?
Yes, ma'am.
I want to bring in another voice on this, someone who served as an officer in Vietnam. He's now the chair of military history at Fort Leavenworth and acted as a consultant for Ken Burns on his new documentary series on Vietnam. Jim Wilbanks, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
What are your thoughts as you listen to Tommy's story?
It's different from my experience. I went much later in the war. I was an advisor with the Arvin. I was not around other Americans. By the time I got there, there was less than 100,000 U.S. troops left in country. And so my experience was totally different.
can you talk to us about your role in the war, what you were doing?
I was an advisor with an Arvin Infantry Regiment. You could really kind of break my tour there into two parts. The first part was pretty uneventful, and then the second part, the Easter Offensive started, and I was involved with a South Vietnamese unit that was part of the surrounded forces at An Lac during the Easter Offensive.
Can you explain what it means to be an advisor?
Well, I was 24 years old. I'd been in the Army 3 years. I was supposed to advise a Vietnamese major battalion commander who'd been fighting most of his life. So my advice was pretty slim, but what I did have the capability to do was to call airstrikes, adjust artillery, and coordinate other U.S. support in support of the South Vietnamese forces I was with.
So as someone who was acting in that role, I would think that, yeah, you would have been in a position that you would have had to be really understanding what was going on in order to steer some kind of course. Did you have questions at the time, things that you were really struggling to understand?
You know, as I said, I was a bit older when I went. I graduated from Texas A&M, which had a strong military background. It was a military school in the sense that's where I got my commission. So I was very well aware of the war. I'd watched classes before mine go off to war. I'd seen some not come back. I understood what the war was about. I understood what my role was. Subsequent to finishing a 23-year career, I started a PhD program at KU, and I've since studied very deeply into the U.S. involvement in Southeast Asia.
But I guess what I'm curious about is, what are the questions that have driven all of that study?
Well, I think everybody wants to put their own personal experience into the larger context, and that's what it was really all about for me. I was there during Vietnamization. I was not there during at the height of U.S. commitment, as your earlier guest was. I was there when we were downsizing the U.S. footprint and turning the war over to the South Vietnamese. And I clearly understood what our mission was. And after 12 months, I went home. There were less than 50,000 U.S. troops in country. And shortly thereafter, the Paris Peace Accords were signed.
When you say that you fully understood the mission, can you summarize to us what it was you understood the mission to be? Because I think, I mean, from just being kind of a student of history, I guess I have heard, I think there are a lot of different versions of that out there, different interpretations.
Well, I think the U.S. objective was clear. That was a free and independent South Vietnam. And after summer of 69, when Nixon announced that he was Vietnamizing the war and beginning to reduce the number of U.S. troops, I think the mission was clear. It was to build, as we use the language today, build capacity on the part of the local forces to assume responsibility for the war as U.S. forces were flown out of country.
Do you watch Vietnam movies?
Yes, I suppose. I don't go out of my way to watch them because most of them are egregiously bad.
Well, that's kind of what I was wondering, is how you feel about them. I think it qualifies as its own genre at this point. What is your response to seeing the way Hollywood has interpreted this conflict?
I find most of them to be unrealistic. For instance, Platoon. Platoon had some very good parts in it, and the director was very good in building an environment. But the idea that all of those things happened in one rifle platoon over the course of a year is just sort of laughable, I think.
What is it that experience tells you about this conflict that a history book doesn't?
Well, I think that my studies in military history about Vietnam are informed by my experience there. So in some cases, when some historians are dealing with a an intellectual construct. It's not that intellectual for me if I was there on the ground during a particular period.
Are you still there? Okay, I think we've lost that guest, but we will turn back to Tommy Pond. Tommy, you know, clearly this other guest has a very different experience from you. What do you think of what you're hearing from him?
Vietnam basically was the time you were there and where you were at. You get different opinions from different people. I was there in 65, and 66 was a lot different from when I was there in 67 and 68. 68 was Tet, which was the worst time you could possibly be there, I think. But like I said, it's where you was at and the time you were there. That's basically what people talk about, because you'll talk about some people was there in 65 and 66, and they were in Saigon. They were in air-conditioned buildings. We were at Chu Lai, and we was at the front. 67 and 68, we was up near the DMZ. Yeah, I was at Khe Sanh and Cam Curl. Well, you don't get no closer to the DMZ than that. So it's all a perspective of where you was at.
Tommy Pond, veteran Marine, stay with us, okay?
Yes, ma'am.
We're talking about the Vietnam War this morning. We've just heard from two local veterans, and coming up, we'll get the perspective of a conscientious objector. You can call, too, 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're looking back on the war in Vietnam 42 years after it ended. What was your experience of the Vietnam War? Do you understand something now that wasn't clear to you at the time? We'd love to hear your story, whether you served, had friends or family who did, or protested here at home. 816-235-2888. I want to turn now to Henry Stover. And Henry, you were a conscientious objector.
Yes, that is correct, Gina. Several years ago, I came to the realization, I just expressed, all my life I've been fighting war. And that goes back to, I was born in 1948 in Germany, of German parents. My dad had attempted to come to this country in 1930 because of depression. He was not allowed in. So our family came in 1951 to a small farming town of Frankfort, Kansas, north of Kansas State University. And my dad had three sisters that were there since the 1920s. And so in growing up, I was trying to get my mind, trying to get an understanding. How was it that there was the extermination of the Jews and the Roma and homosexual? And why was Germany seen as an aggressor in two world wars? And how can I right wrongs? I mean, I was born in 1948, and yet I felt some responsibility. And so I end up looking at things from an entirely different perspective, you know, the German legacy, kind of, you know, being told, you know, not to be aggressive, be the nice kid. And so you know, during high school, I was already reading sensitive books. I read John Hershey's Hiroshima. And in college, I ended up reading a biography of Tolstoy, Count Tolstoy, and I read his War and Peace. And I heard Martin Luther King Jr. when he came to Kansas State University. And it was an entirely different era. You know, this was an era. Oh, I should back up. While I was at Kansas State, I took one semester of ROTC. I wanted to see what it was about. And we had film clips showing, you know, bombing and destruction. And almost all of the students thought it was funny and humorous. And I was just horrified because I knew that one-fourth of the housing in Germany was destroyed, and all the major cities suffered a great loss. And so I'm kind of between these two worlds with a perspective of what happened in World War II And then so I'm kind of carrying on long. So, Gina, if you want to jump in.
Well, question. I mean, hearing the background to your decision to become a conscientious objector is really interesting, and I want to get back to it. But how did that work? Can you explain how it works to become a conscientious objector?
In 1968, my father and I went back to see my grandmother in the little town of Memmingen, Germany. It was West Germany, I think, at the time. And so I went to where the train station was, and they had many international magazines. And I took considerable time of looking at these magazines. And they had pictures of My Lai and the use of napalm and, you know, the bombings that went on and the people being rounded up in internment camps because they wanted to move people out from the countryside to not be, you know, maybe giving aid to the other side or joining the other side. And I was just horrified by that. And then I went to the Woodstock Rock Festival in 1969, and Joan Baez was one of the singers the first night, and she said, "My husband, David Harris, has refused to be inducted. He's a war resister, and please remember, you know, David." And there were other rock and roll groups, Country Joe and the Fish, that, you know, had the Draft Dodger rag. You know, there was a lot of talk. And yet this town, this temporary town of 1/3 of a million people, had no police force, nobody with guns. We all got along. We helped each other. And then when I came back and started my senior year, then I went and filled out a declaration, you know, that I wish to be a conscientious objector to all wars.
Where do you fill that declaration out? Where did you go?
Okay, I tell you, I was at Kansas State University, and I knew that my draft board was in Marysville, Kansas, the county seat of Marshall County. And so I don't know that I even had, like, an official form. I simply, you know, just wrote, you know, a letter to them. And then they sent me for a physical, and there's nothing wrong with my body, and the physicals are a farce. And then they asked me to come in to meet with them face-to-face, the three members of the draft board. And they had a series of questions, and I could, you know, I could make a statement. And, you know, my parents, being from Germany, they did not approve of my filing for requesting to be a conscientious objector. They said, you know, well, every boy, you know, high school boy, if he doesn't go to college, doesn't get deferments, you know, then if they're asked to go to the military, they do it and whatever. And they didn't really understand how pained I was with the Holocaust and with, you know, people very much disliked Germans. I mean, you know, I was called a Kraut and a Nazi and whatever. And here I'm a little kid, you know, going to picking up the language at 4 years of age. And also I was, you know, like much better read, you know, than my parents. And so after meeting with my draft board a couple of months later, I get this notice that I received a CO status and that I need to work somewhere at least 150 miles away from my hometown. So I looked at some places like the Menninger Mental Health Institute in Topeka.
But wait, it was a simple. So you met with them. There are three people and they just said,
yes.
Okay, just find someplace else to serve.
They had asked a number of questions, and I don't think that they had faced this situation. I don't know that they had, you know, maybe written to the national office, like, what should we write? What should, you know, our inquiry be? And so they had to, you know, see, well, was I just objecting? Was I just selecting this war, or was it all wars? And, you know, in my years of growing up, I paid very much attention to international situations, whether it was the blockade of Berlin or whether it was the Czech uprising in 1968 or the Hungarian resistance, I think, in 1956, the Cuban Missile Crisis, all of those things. I, you know, I was focused with that. And so, you know, I answered the questions. And then, you know,
But what questions? What did they want to know?
I tell you, they want to know if you are truly and truly sincere. Are you going to just sit out this war? Are you going to fight the next war? And for example, you know, I told
them. They wanted to make sure this was like a principled decision and not.
Exactly. Principled. Not just someone who says, you know, I don't want to go or whatever. So, like, you know, one of the questions that they ask is, would you have fought Adolf Hitler? And of course, I said, yeah, well, that's a speculative, hypothetical question. The war ended in 45. I was born in 48. He was not even around. But if I was around when the Nazi government was in power, I would not have participated. I would have gone underground. I would have, you know, left for Switzerland or somewhere else. You know, it was just too evil that, you know, to be a part of that. So, and I, you know, it took several months. I had like no idea which way they were going to go with their decision. These were persons that all had been veterans, and they had volunteered to be on a draft board. So then I was sent to KU Med Center in Kansas City, Kansas, and I did 2 years of alternative service. And because I had a college degree, I mean, I told them I'm willing to do anything, clean, you know, toilets and whatever. I need some rubber gloves because I have sensitive fingers, skin. But, you know, so they assigned me to the dietary department. And so part of the day was updating menus. I mean, doctor's orders. And part of the day was going out and meeting the patients. And in my frock that I had on, I always had a peace button on as a way to kind of start the conversation.
How did that go? How did that conversation go when you're there at KU Med, which I assume drew a cross-section of people with all different views? How did that?
You know, it was a specialty hospital because persons with unusual illnesses were referred by Kansas rural doctors. And, you know, some persons said wonderful, and some persons it just did not sit with them, you know, right at all. And I expected, you know, that because there was a wide divergency of views. And I tell you, in kind of like leading up to this, our country went through an epic transformation. We had Senator Eugene McCarthy challenge Lyndon Baines Johnson, and then Johnson in 68 declared he wouldn't run. We had Martin Luther King assassinated in 1968, and he spoke about the evils of racism and war and how we were not, you know, doing what we should be doing in our country. Bobby Kennedy was assassinated in 68. The Berrigan brothers, Catholic priest, entered into a Catonville draft board office and set the draft records on fire, making a concoction resembling napalm. You had Cassius Clay becoming a Muhammad Ali, saying that he was exempt as a Muslim minister. And just as any Christian clergy, he should be exempt from being drafted. And his case went up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they upheld, you know, that the draft board, the hearings did not do him justice. They set, you know, a wrong standard, a different standard for him. We had the civil rights movement that, you know, impressed about basic rights being denied, persons beaten, water hosed, jailed, the use of nonviolence to bring out change. Yeah, we had the baby doctor.
It was a time of major social upheaval, which I think is
That's kind of right.
A way of summarizing where you're going with this. But
yes.
Just to get back to the experience of being a conscientious objector at this time, I mean, how did you think back then about people like Tommy, the Marine we've been talking to, and Jim, who was an officer?
I have the greatest respect for Tommy and for Dr. James or Jim Wilbanks. You know, they were following orders. They did not have the inside information. I personally wish that we had prosecuted persons like Robert McNamara and maybe LBJ, because they had information and they knew that the information they were putting out were lies, and they continued upping the war. And Robert McNamara sends something back, and this is what I learned in Ken Burns's program, you know, that, oh, in 6 months we'll be sending their troops back, we will have beaten the enemy. And so there was so much deception going on by General Westmoreland and others, and we were doing the body counts.
But so you didn't personally begrudge people like Tommy and Jim. I want to bring them back into this conversation.
That's right. Yes. I mean, I befriended some Vietnam veterans against the war. You know, whether it was a number of people. But go ahead, Gina.
Yeah, I want to go ahead and bring Jim and Tommy back in to respond to some of what they've heard you say. Jim, first of all, I'm sorry that we got cut off from each other earlier. What are some of your thoughts as you hear Henry's story?
Well, I certainly respect his perspective and respect what he did following his own beliefs, but I was following mine as well.
Talk to me about your beliefs.
I was raised in a military family. I went to a military school. I volunteered to go to Vietnam because I thought that that's where I was supposed to be. I was an infantry officer. I thought it was my duty. And I, as an advisor, my job was to help the South Vietnamese. And that's what I did. And I am proud of my service. And I would do it again.
Can you talk to me about that sense of duty a little bit? For people who have never served in the military and don't come from that kind of background, it might be hard to understand how deeply held that belief is and where it comes from.
Well, I think a lot comes from your family. My father was in the Army. I was raised in the Army. I was around it my entire life. I saw people doing their duty for their country, and it was just natural that I would do the same. That's how I ended up at Texas A&M and got a commission in the infantry. I actually was first assigned to Germany, but it felt wrong to me because the country was still at war, and I felt my place to be was Vietnam, so I volunteered to go.
You know, I want to also hear from Tommy on this. Tommy, tell me a little bit more about your life at the time when you became a Marine and what that opportunity represented to you.
Changed in the 4 years I was in there. But it, like I said, at the time I graduated from high school in 64, very few people even heard of Vietnam. My thing was join the Marine Corps for 4 years, like a normal person, get out and get a job. That was it. But while I was in there, things changed. And when he mentioned duty, that was instilled in you as a Marine, I guess in every branch of the service, but people say Marines, we're arrogant and stuff. But we just, it's duty. And black, white, green, or purple, especially in 1965 and 66, on my first 19 months the first time, it was duty. You did what you were told to do because you were a Marine.
You know, you just made a reference to race, and I'm curious about the role of race in your experience, both in Vietnam and here at home, like before leaving, coming back.
I didn't think of it. Well, Kansas City, you're too young. It was a very segregated city when I grew up.
And our listeners can't see you, so maybe sharing with them how you identify.
As a black American, I have a conversation with a friend of mine at Vietnam Veteran 317. We were talking about I grew up as a busboy, working as a busboy when I was in high school. He said, well, I was a busboy too, but the main difference was the sign where he went to work didn't say, we don't serve colored people. That was the main difference between me and him. He didn't have a sign out front saying, we don't serve white people.
And when you talk about black, white, green, or purple, that everyone's duty is the same in the military, can you talk to me about what that meant to you?
It meant a lot. In the Marine Corps in 65, we didn't discuss it, and race was not discussed. I don't know about other branches of service, but the Marine Corps, most of what, it was not then. In my second tour, after I'd been there 19 months, I went back in 67 and 68 because we had people coming over that the riots were going on, and they were getting drafted, and they were drafting Marines then. So these people didn't want to be there, but they were drafted Marines by then, and they were coming over, and I didn't know what was going on in the States here. It would be in Stars and Stripes, but I didn't know the extent of it until I got back home out in 68. And I had a lot of friends, a couple that were killed in the riots here in Kansas City. And that made me look at things a little bit differently. But
In what sense?
Well, in the sense was I was over there fighting and they were killing people here in Kansas City. I would have still did my job as a Marine. It had nothing to do with my job as a Marine. I just didn't think about that when I was over there. And I can see why some blacks came over there angry. And I didn't understand it when I was. In fact, they called me an Uncle Tom. Not to my face, because I was a sergeant, a corporal and a sergeant then, and they would get in trouble for doing that. But I did not understand why they would do this. I thought I was an okay black dude, but it was just I wasn't subject to what they were subject to back here.
Because you were away.
I was away. I did not see that, what was going on, until I came back.
You know, you joined the Marine Corps just right out of high school,
yes.
Right? And some of what we've been hearing from our conscientious objector has to do with his college degree. Do you think that it made a difference in terms of just the role people filled when they served in the war, or just going or not going, that level of education?
I don't think so, because I did know a lot of our officers that came in the Marine Corps. The war was going on, and they were graduating from college, and they came on in the Marine Corps. I think it's an individual thing. I would have been drafted if I had not joined the Marine Corps in 64 during the war. At least by 66, I'd have been drafted. So I don't think it has to do with education. It just has to do with the kind of person you are.
Henry, what do you think about that?
Well, I know that some persons in Vietnam were very caring, and some persons just, went berserk. It's like war sometimes unleashes the worst things that a person can be. And someone that was a Nuremberg prosecutor ended up saying those words, that war unleashes a great evil. But I was not there. I fought my own, battles here, but I was not in their shoes. So I am not going to condemn or be critical of them. I am critical of the deception that our leaders did on the American people, that they expanded the war.
We will get back to that with our former officer Jim Wilbanks, who is also a consultant to Ken Burns on his Vietnam documentary, when we get back. We also have just a little while left when we return for your calls at 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. Welcome back to KCUR Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, talking with Tommy Pond, who was a Marine from 1964 to 1968. He served 2.5 tours in Vietnam. Jim Wilbanks, who's chair of military history at 4th Leavenworth's Command and General Staff College. He's also a veteran who served as an officer and a consultant to Ken Burns on his Vietnam documentary series. And Henry Stover, a conscientious objector. We are looking back at the Vietnam War 42 years later. And Jim, I want to talk to you some more, because Henry has brought up sort of the thinking and the highest level decision making in the Vietnam War. And because you are both an officer and an advisor and someone who has even been a consultant to Ken Burns, I'm curious what you think about that.
Well, I can certainly tell you, as a young captain, I didn't have a lot of information on what was going on at the policy levels. The country was at war. Our mission was to help the South Vietnamese. I was an infantry officer, eminently qualified to do that, and so I went to Vietnam and did that. In my studies after I retired at KU, I became intimately involved or aware of all the decision-making processes and some of the things a lot of things I did not know as a captain. But that's also the result of about 25 years of study here.
Does that Does that change at all how you feel about what you were doing, or no? You've said that you would go back and do it again.
No, it certainly puts it in context, but I will tell you, within the larger construct of assisting the South Vietnamese, I thought it was the right thing to do, and I did the best that I could in the year that I was there. And in the process, was wounded twice. So at the end of the day, I was proud of what I did, and as I said before, I would do it again. I thought the South Vietnamese people deserved that.
What is it that Ken Burns wanted to know from you, and what did you tell him?
Well, that's kind of interesting, because when we first started out, I read the script the first time, and I didn't like it. So at our first script meeting, I told him that I didn't think I wanted to be involved in the process.
What didn't you like about it?
Well, initially it contained a lot of the 80s tropes that everybody is haunted by their service and everyone kills civilians, and the usual things that gets played up in the popular culture that you mentioned earlier. And that just wasn't my experience. I think there are hundreds of thousands of veterans like myself, and I won't speak for Tommy, but it sounds like he's proud of his service as well, who went and did the best job they could, as honorably as they could, under some really difficult situations and conditions, and came home proud of their service. And I thought that that voice needed to be heard.
Let's talk now with Marvin, who's calling us from Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Marvin.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you. So my experience is I was born in an Air Force base in England in 65, and my dad got shipped off to Thailand in 66 and October 66 and got shot down over North Vietnam in January 67 and spent 6.5 years in probably 5 different prison camps and the Hanoi Hilton as well. And then came back in 73 when I was 7 years old. And he's very proud of his service. And I'm very proud of his service as well. But I think it really shaped my viewpoint of war and just the implications it has, not only on the service member, but their families and the extended families. And it shaped how I kind of formed my adult life. And I ended up going back to Vietnam in 2008 and 2009 and working with a service organization to in North Vietnam to kind of give back, if you will, or to try to go back and get some sort of sense of my own peace and just making sense of what that war meant, not only for the people that were there fighting, but then the ripple effects that it had back here.
What ripple effect did it have on you? I mean, you've said that it shaped you, but what was your experience?
So when my mom, when he left, I was one, and she was very much a stereotypical housewife in the 60s. And through the time that my dad was there, and she found about 2.5 years after he got shot down that he was alive. And she became very much into the, I guess I'll say the anti-war movement, really, but to bring the prisoners back home and to stop the war. And she became, when he came back in 73, she was a very dynamic woman and become kind of been able to stand on her own. He had more or less been kept in a time capsule while he was there and came back to, as Tommy has alluded to, just kind of the change in what happened throughout the war or during the years that the war was going on. And for me to see that change in my mom, and then also most of the POWs and their wives did not stay married. So I don't know what the percentage, but I'm sure it's extremely high as far as the divorce rate. And then the struggles and the tensions that took place between the spouses. But I considered a career in the military when I was in high school, and my mom said no way, and then I wasn't going to be able to pass the physicals either, but I often wonder if I would have gone that direction, what would have happened. But I still wanted to be a part of making sense of it, so that's why I chose to go back there. So I made a conscious effort to go back and to speak with people there and to understand. And as I was mentioning to the when I called in, is that the Vietnamese love the United States. At least my experience there in North Vietnam was that they really love and they respect Americans. They emulate us considerably, and they're very entrepreneurial at this point, and embrace as much as they can kind of a capitalistic aspect. But since it dawned on me, since they won the war. They've been able to move on in a lot of ways, and their social structure has put that to rest, more or less, or come to peace with it, whereas there's still so much conversation, which I think is healthy, but there's still so much going on, and how it tended to maybe rip us apart even more so than it did there and at least in northern Vietnam. I haven't been to southern Vietnam, but...
Well, thank you for that call, Marvin.
Sure.
Let's turn now to Colleen in Independence. Hi, Colleen.
Hello.
What do you want to share with us?
Well, I am the widow of a 100% disabled Vietnam veteran. We buried him this year, August 25th, at the Leavenworth National Cemetery. I know a lot about his experience, but I'm particularly interested in talking to Mr. Will Banks about his artwork and his effects. Mark was an artist and drew a series of 30 or so scenes from partly from memory, part from original photographs of his experience in Vietnam. And I'm very anxious to get these to some organization or person who's interested in them. Things like the letter he wrote his mother, including the little piece of shrapnel in a plastic bag. So I'll let you prompt me from here.
Well, Colleen, we can put you in touch off the air about that, but I wonder what you can tell us, having looked at all of these things. What do they tell you about your husband's experience, or what do you need us to understand about yours?
He was proud of his service. He was mentally and emotionally damaged by his experience. When he got back for 20 years, he just wandered around on the fringes of society. He built a bunker the fire department couldn't tear down. He lived in a cave. He lived in cardboard boxes. And finally, someone took the VA to him where he was living in a cave. He spent a year in Topeka, Kansas, in treatment, and came out and began to build a regular life. Where do we go from there?
Yeah, Colleen, thank you for your call. And when I put you back on hold, you can tell our producer your contact information, and we'll get you in touch with Jim Wilbanks, okay?
All right, thank you.
Okay, thanks. Tommy Pond, I want to turn to you because you have mentioned that in your second tour of duty, things had gotten really much more intense, that things were, as you put it, bad, you know. And it sounds like things were bad for the family members of our callers, too. And I wonder if you can shine some light on that for us.
Yeah, they were bad at home, and I didn't know about home, realize how bad it was there, but they were really bad in Vietnam during 67 and definitely 68. The people there doing Tet will tell you how bad it was, terribly bad, especially if you were up north at Way or Khe Sanh or Camp Carroll, any place up north. It was really, really bad. And I just remember that the most. I remember coming back home. I still remember that morning. I didn't know how bad they were until I stepped off that airplane here in Kansas City. I found out how bad it was, what people were saying to me.
Let's go ahead and talk. You know, I want to bring Jim Wilbanks back in this. Jim, what are you feeling hearing some of these other stories?
Well, I certainly understood the situation. If you have a drafty army, it reflects the society from which it comes from. So if that society is beset by racial difficulties, it has upheaval in the streets, the sooner or later that's going to be visited on the military and the military in Vietnam. So when you begin to see those kinds of problems in American society, you see them within the American military and inside the military in Vietnam. And of course, the last thing is, as we begin to leave in 69, you begin to ask yourself, do you want to be the last guy killed in Vietnam?
That's a pretty heavy question. Care to say more about it?
Well, there's certainly a line of thought that says, if we're going home anyway, why go out and risk your life? And so then you begin to see some indiscipline within the ranks. So the Army that's fighting in 1970 and 71 is not the same Army that's there in 1965.
Yeah. Well, Jim, thank you. And I want to thank all of our guests today. We were just hearing from Jim Wilbanks, Chair of Military History at Fort Leavenworth. We've also been hearing from Tommy Pond, who was a Marine, and Henry Stover, a conscientious objector. You can keep talking to us on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. Tomorrow, we will have a show hosted by Glenn North. I'll be away. He is our celebrity guest host, and it's going to be awesome, so tune in. Our show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan, with lots of help from intern Tom Taylor. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around.